But revenue can't be ignored anymore in any of our conversations. And that we're making a shift in this academic year to the first time in our 4.5 years talking about Acadium bringing alternative revenue to our member institutions, which was sort of at the bottom of the list of benefits. They'd be like, oh, and you can bring some revenue back. And that was always our top message for CFOs and presidents, but now it's our message more broadly.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast. Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. I'm Tiffany Snyder, and I'm here with my co-host, the Brad Garner. Hi, Brad.
Wow, I've never gotten the "the" before.
I know, I just added
it. I am thrilled to be here. Thrilled.
We are joined today by the Nathan Green of Acadium. Nathan Green is an experienced entrepreneur and executive with a focus on building new products, markets, and clients within the edtech industry. He is a co-founder and the chief development officer at Acadium, the largest network of institutions in higher education. In this role, Nathan and his team are responsible for expanding the network internationally into dual credit and employee education, as well as adjunct industries to improve revenue for institutions and outcomes for students. Most recently, Nathan founded the Austin Young Chamber of Commerce and Campus to Careers, which was acquired by SureScore and then Double Line Partners. Previously, Nathan held leadership positions at Pearson, the Everest Group, Bloomberg, and Accenture, where he began his career. Nathan is a graduate of Cornell University, married to a comp lit professor at UMass Amherst, and father of 3 young kids ages 2 through 8. Please join us in welcoming to the podcast, Nathan.
Thanks so much for having me, Tiffany.
Yeah. We like to get the show started with some fun getting to know you questions. And this first one, we're curious about because we don't even know what sports or clubs you're a part of now or later in your life, but we're going to send you all the way back to junior high. So if you were to do junior high over again and you could join a club, a sport, or a group, what would you select and why?
That's a great question. So I played tennis in college.
Oh.
And have not picked up a racket seriously since. Hoping to get my kids out on the tennis court at some point soon. But what I would have benefited from, I think even more and would have enjoyed if I would have started younger, was cooking.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't have cooking clubs back in the day. I know that that's a more popular option these days. I guess we're not offering maybe home ec as much perhaps as a classroom opportunity. But yeah, I think I would have loved learning how to cook at a younger age. My wife would have appreciated if I started younger. And so yeah, I think the answer would be joining a cooking club of some kind.
I love it.
So what are some of the best dishes on the Nathan Green menu?
Sadly, that's why I needed to start sooner. You know, it's heating up something from Trader Joe's. I don't know if that counts as an original recipe.
Absolutely.
It's good stuff.
But no, I've learned how to cook a really good burger on the grill and certainly I've adapted, but it would have been beneficial to start that at a younger age.
Very good.
I agree with that.
Good. So I imagine you've been on some Zoom meetings in the last 18 months, a couple of them at least. Any pet peeves that you observe in Zoom participants?
And you can't pick ones that you see of us now because we are recording via Zoom, so be careful.
So my day is 60 to 70% Zoom or meeting, which is turned into Zoom and whatever other teleconference option our institutions or partners want to use. I had one client in particular, I won't name names, but one client in particular that every meeting, the entire discussion was revolving around whatever dog or cat was in their lap. And so my pet peeve is actually the pets in the Zoom meetings, which, you know, I've got kids that run through, but I don't spend the entire time talking about them. It's always a fun little break in the conversation, especially when my 8-year-old ran past my screen naked coming out of the shower yesterday.
Oh, my goodness.
And I called it out, but I moved on. But this one pet peeve is a client who you know, I felt like we spent 20 minutes of every meeting talking about whatever animal was on their lap. And they're really into dogs and cats. And he had six different ones that would visit him during the meeting. And it was a pet peeve that we spent so much time talking about the animals and not about the students. Our focus is the students and not the four-legged.
So. Oh, that's funny.
I have a new idea for Twitter. We'll take this little segment that Nathan just did.
Yeah.
We'll put it on Twitter and we'll say, who is Nathan Green talking about? We'll have a contest.
Where's Waldo? Where's Waldo?
Yeah. People will be submitting photos of each other with their pets. All right. One more question for you on this segment. On what game show, current or former, are you most likely to succeed?
Yeah. So I wish I could say Jeopardy or one of those games that require intellect or just knowledge. And, you know, there are a bunch of game shows I'd love to be on just because of the prizes. But yeah. I think Family Feud would be my answer.
Yeah.
Very good.
And yeah, I'm definitely one of those shows that I love watching as a kid. Ray Combs Day. Now it's Steve Harvey. I love the energy that Steve brings. But I had a really close family growing up. We're still close. In fact, my brother came out. He's a dean at University of Chicago. He came out during the pandemic and lived across the street from us. My parents live across the street.
Oh,
so we
nice.
Have this really close-knit family that allowed us to thrive, maybe not even survive, but thrive during the pandemic. And so I feel like we would do well on that show. We know each other intimately. At some point, my wife would say too intimately. especially after the year, my brother and his family across the street. But we come from a family of academics. Both my parents were academic administrators, and you know, my brother and I followed suit. We married professors, and
oh wow,
I feel like we would do very well on the Family Feud.
So that reminds me of the show Everybody Loves Raymond.
Me too. Everybody loves absolutely. Nathan.
When you see one of your relatives walking across the street, you quickly turn the lights off and everybody gets quiet.
Yeah. There have been moments, Brad, where we pretended we weren't here. But no, you know, what I loved about my brother's return to Chicago was just there were two homes to go to. And the kids would just come back and forth.
Yep.
And they were all in virtual school. And I wouldn't want to go back to that ever again. But as far as pandemics went, it was a you know, bearable option for all of us.
I think in some ways the pandemic might have drawn families closer together with that need to reach out and talk to other people, see what they're doing.
Yeah, I was traveling before the pandemic. I was traveling 80%. So I missed many meals with the kids, and I didn't miss a single meal with the kids in the last 16 months. And that has many more benefits than challenges. But, you know, everything else was a challenge. But there were some real benefits of being close to home. Or stuck in the home.
You could probably hear your kids saying, when's daddy going to get home and make us a burger?
Yeah, or when is daddy going to leave and we can get a burger at a real place with Five Guys. But,
oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Acadium and kind of leading up to that, your career journey to where you are at this moment.
Yeah, so I'll start from the beginning. I graduated from Cornell University and was pursuing a programming or engineering path and started at Accenture in developing software, specifically databases for clients, and learned quickly that I was also good at talking to clients. So they put me client-facing project management, and ultimately I got stuck. I thought of it as stuck at that moment in my career with the New York City Department of Education. And that was my first client in the education space. And I just found a calling that I had avoided with my parents and my brother in the education space, that I realized the rest of my career I would devote to education. I quickly reverted to higher education after that, joined Harcourt, which was acquired by Pearson. And after that acquisition, they shuffled the deck. And I got a nice golden parachute, as they say, and was able to start my own company. A company called Campus Two Careers that got acquired a few times. And that led me to being an investor and founder of at the time, a company we called the College Consortium. And the College Consortium is like the Five College Consortium or the Claremont College Consortium, but using online education instead of a shuttle bus. And so we're based in Austin, Texas. That's where I was. And my co-founders are. Here's the irony is that when I explained who we were at the time, I would say, well, we're like the five college consortium for the rest of the world through online education instead of a shuttle bus. And then my wife graduated with her PhD at UT and got her dream job, which I joke is any paying job in humanities these days, at UMass Amherst. So now I live in the backyard of the five college consortium. So, you know, I was prophetic or manifest destiny kind of thing. I ended up here because I used that reference too many times. And really what we're after is this concept of an extended catalog. Schools like Indiana Wesleyan already have an extended catalog. Their online division extend the catalog for the on-ground campus by many multipliers. They offer accelerated when the student needs an option in a non-traditional term. But most schools don't look like Indiana Wesleyan or University of Incarnate Word or Southern New Hampshire, right? And they're competing with the Southern New Hampshires if you're in my backyard. And so we extend their catalog by creating collaboration. And really, we just did three things. We created a cross-registration, or think of it as a reservation system between institutions, right? So that's sharing data and dollars seamlessly between schools. The next thing we did is we aggregated empty seats that are otherwise worth $0 to what we call the teaching institution. And that aggregation is not unlike what you would see with a Travelocity or a Hotels.com. In fact, I say we're Hotels.com for higher ed in some examples. And the third thing we do is we work with the institutions on how to course share. And sort of the history that we don't talk about today because we've learned our mistake is that in our early days, we would say, well, there's no change management. You're a school, you need a course for a student, you click the button. And no one, no institutions, no registrars, no advisors, no administrators ever just click the button. Because course sharing, while it's something we've gotten used to as a consumer, like I go to Kayak to look my flights, and then I go to directly to the airline that I think is the best route, as an institution, as an ecosystem, higher ed doesn't share easily. They collaborate well, but they don't share well. And so we've had to spend countless hours getting schools to get comfortable clicking the button, choosing another college's course. The threat to faculty is so immense, I'm often sleeping on the couch. It is something we have to work through at every institution. Even the innovative ones are still digesting what it means to share a course or a degree with another institution.
What is your message to faculty or to even the innovative institution that's still trying to digest this kind of partnership or collaboration?
Yeah, great question. So our goal is to help them understand that they're already sharing students through the form of, you know, student dropouts and transfer outs and then ultimately what we call transfer credit, where students take a course at another college and then transfer the transcript back. So we always start there. Like, how many students took a course at a college outside of your institution last year? Let's just bring all that revenue and control back. Let's give your faculty more control. Let's show them faculty credentials and syllabi instead of just a 300-word course description so that it's never as good as your course, but it's still the best alternative option for your students. So we always start with the student in mind. We want to be student-focused. And then there are some schools that say, look, I want to build a new degree. I don't have the budget to hire the faculty, or I can't find the faculty. I'm in the middle of Appalachia. One of our partnerships is with the Appalachia College Association, getting a computer science faculty to come to a remote part of Tennessee or Virginia is hard. So they can now lean on a school like Indiana Wesleyan that has the curriculum and the faculty without having to invest in that line. And ultimately, all of our schools, Tiffany, to your question, they all want to grow.
Yeah.
They all want to develop their own programs. They all want to add more online. So maybe we're just a temporary measure, right? Maybe we're the opportunity to kind of try before you buy and invest in that new degree. But that's where we're getting our inroads, right? It's got to be something non-threatening or strengthening what the faculty see as their area of domain and influence, which is you're going to send your student to another college for a course. Why not pick it from another faith-based school through the CCCU or another four-year school that you can see syllabi and learning outcomes and faculty credentials? I'm always shocked when we say, well, you can also bring back revenue. Faculty say, I don't care about that. Well, where's your salary? Who pays your salary?
They are oblivious to that. Oblivious.
Yeah. Your institution's in the red right now.
Yes.
So let's bring some revenue back together. Like, let's also bring back control, and let's also strengthen the experience for the student. But revenue can't be ignored anymore in any of our conversations. And that we're making a shift in this academic year to the first time in our 4.5 years talking about Acadium bringing alternative revenue to our member institutions, which was sort of at the bottom of the list of benefits. It'd be like, oh, and you can bring some revenue back. And that was always our top message for CFOs and presidents, but now it's our message more broadly.
Wow.
It's a brilliant model. And I think I will go so far as to say it's the future of higher education, those kinds of interactions. What does this look like from the student side?
Yeah, it's a great question, Brad. So the student knows that they're going somewhere else. It's visible when they're registering for the course, and it's going to say their school's logo on the top of that page, but then each course they see is an individual tile with the teaching institution's logo on it. So they'll see, they might be at Mount St. Mary's College, but they're going to see the Indiana Wesleyan logo on the course tile. And so they know that the course is coming from somewhere else. They know through the messaging of our system and hopefully their advising department or their registrar, whoever it is that's advising them to go to our system to find them, request the course, they know that there's going to be a different faculty, a different LMS, a different schedule possibly. And so all of that, we try to over communicate. The fact that the student may pay extra beyond the block is dependent upon how the home institution implements or what term it is. From then on, we really are the bridge between the institutions. So we check in with the student, make sure they get their login and other credentials, that they start class, and that they make progress to completion. But it is a different experience. They're going to see different students in the class. The faculty might have a different methodology. They might be more hands-off or more hands-on. But I would argue, and I do argue, that when faculty say, well, this is going to be a different experience for students, my argument is, well, it's always a different experience for students. Your faculty all teach in different styles. And so there's just a bit of additional communication that this is actually from another college, but it will count towards your degree here. And so we like to say that this is always the best alternate option. It's never the best option, but it's the best backup option. And that you should communicate to the student and their parents that you as the institution, the home institution, are going above and beyond to get that student a course they need when your own school doesn't offer it in the schedule. So we try to turn what is conceived as a negative into a positive so that the students feel like they're more supported and that they're given a second chance or a second schedule. And that seems to resonate well. We are pushing, Brad, to your question, that when you walk into admissions and you say, I want to come to this school over all the other schools in my area, some of which are public versus private, some of which are 2-year versus 4-year, I choose you because you're part of the consortium. And that means that you have more chances to graduate in 4 years, which, and we know the data, most students actually graduate 6 years for a 4-year degree. And that's just, as a parent, that's a real concern. And it's often the student's fault, right? They make bad decisions, like transferring degrees in their 4th year. Like you can't transfer to another degree or another college and not expect a delay. But some of it is the fact that schools don't have extended schedules. They don't have accelerated programs. And so you get out of sync, and now I'm a year behind. And most of our degrees, sadly, in America today are lockstep, inflexible, and they have these AB courses that effectively they miss one course and they're now more than a year behind. And that's a major problem for higher ed that we're looking to solve for.
Excellent. Excellent.
This has been a rich conversation with Nathan Green of Acadium, and the conversation does not end here. We'll be back next week on the Digital to Learn podcast, so join us then.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are 3 things we ask you to do. 1, come back and join us again. 2, tell your friends about us. And 3, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.